Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Got a lot to talk about over the course of these 2 hours, including the polarizing hyperlocal app Nextdoor, which many Southern Californians turn to for news about their neighborhoods. We'll find out what sorts of changes the app is going to be making to try and deal with some of the concerns that have been raised about the nature of conversation on Nextdoor. But first, we begin with our weekly guest talking about COVID-19 from UC San Francisco Medical Center, Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, so good to have you with us again.
Same here, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
We typically do a tech check with our guests in the hour before airtime. And one of the things our engineer Parker asks is what our guest had for breakfast. And I understand you had a morning bun with orange zest. What is a morning bun?
It's kind of like a lighter version of a sticky bun. And it's usually flavored. There's swirls of like toothsome bits of fruit or spices. And, you know, if you look at the Swedish variant, it has cardamom in it. So I love all of these little variants of buns, kind of like coronavirus variants, but not quite.
I was gonna say, see, you're educating us even culinarily as we open up Air Talk. And Natalie, our line producer today, she guessed what it was. She nailed exactly what you said it was. So we begin with one of the most important questions of the day. But seriously, turning our attention to where we are on COVID-19, the news continues to be quite good, doesn't it?
It looks really good. I think we've been continuing to decline in terms of California cases, hospitalizations, and most importantly, we've caught up with the rest of the country and then some in terms of getting our vaccine doses into the arms of Californians.
Let's talk about vaccination, because one of the concerns yesterday, we went statewide with people with conditions making them vulnerable to more serious COVID being prioritized for vaccination. First of all, that's millions of Californians, and going to make it difficult to get an appointment. But secondly, because there is no requirement for proof of that underlying condition, it essentially is an honor system, opening up the door for anybody who you know wants to get a vaccine to pretty much be able to do it just through a testing. They have an underlying condition. Are you concerned about that, or do you feel like essentially it's okay for everybody to go out and get a vaccine if they can get an appointment?
I think it's okay because we have to accept some sort of gaming of the system if we want to decrease the barriers to the people who need it the most. And at the end of the day, we want everyone to be vaccinated. Of course, we want people to be honorable about it and have some sort of personal barriers in terms of not gaming the system. But I'd much prefer that to happen than to have people in vulnerable communities be stymied by getting a doctor's note and calling in and all of that, because I'd really want them to get it as soon as possible.
How far away are we from, you know, more robust service of vaccines into communities where there's great need, where transportation is limited, where people might have a difficult time getting away from work to schedule an appointment or to go to a vaccine appointment? It seems to me there'd be so much benefit, particularly with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, to just, you know, drive that out through communities, be able to even go into homes to vaccinate those that are bedridden. How far are we away from being able to do that?
I think we're probably on the way, but obviously not close to that. And you mentioned some of the barriers, Larry. I think we need to be more nimble, flexible. There are reports of pharmacists, for example, going in with leftover doses, setting up pop-up clinics. All of this needs to be done. We need to have a lot of redundancy in communities with low SES and communities of color, vulnerable communities, because that's the community that has faced the brunt of disease and also the community with the lowest amount of access to vaccines and setting up appointments, digital divide, and all of that.
Now, individuals in those communities are going to get a total population benefit, so to speak, as other people get vaccinated, right? So even if they're having trouble at this point early on getting an appointment or getting to a vaccination site, they are still getting some degree of benefit, right?
Yeah, they are, because the state allocation is supposed to devote at least 40% of doses to these communities, and as defined by the Healthy People's Index in California, which is the lowest 1/5 in terms of quintiles with education and occupation and all that. So on paper, it looks good. But again, the devil is always in the details.
All right. Well, your questions for Dr. Peter Chin Hong were at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We've had additional countries in Europe suspending the use of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine over concerns of cases where individuals develop blood clots after receiving the vaccine. The World Health Organization's continued to say that it is a safe vaccine and that there's not evidence that the blood clots are caused by the AstraZeneca vaccine. What do you think about these countries taking this step?
I think it's a bit premature, to tell you the truth. Of course, we don't know what the real answer is, but I think it's premature for several reasons. First, blood clots is not something that vaccines do in the history of vaccines. It doesn't have a lot of biologic plausibility. You know, we expect things where your immune system is super angry and it just zooms into places, so lymph nodes, all of these kinds of effects that we've been seeing make sense to me, inflammation around certain organs. But a blood clot is kind of a different biologic process. So it's kind of strange for me that it would be linked to the vaccine, or actually it's not been linked. And I think that's the WHO's point. The UK actually did a good comparison of people who've gotten the vaccine. There have been 17 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine administered so far, and they found no difference, in at least in preliminary analysis, between almost 10 million people in the UK gotten the AstraZeneca vaccine, between people and blood clots who've gotten it and people who didn't get it.
And let's expand on that a little bit, because I think it's sometimes difficult for us as lay people to fully understand the numbers when they're thrown around. We're getting into numbers now of so many people being vaccinated and then a certain small subset having health conditions that follow that. As pattern-seeking human beings, it's very easy for us to attribute those responses as though they're causal from the vaccine. And speak to that, if you will, because I would assume when you're dealing with flu vaccination or anything else, you're always going to have a subset of people who have some sort of an adverse event happen afterward that likely has nothing to do with the vaccine itself.
Exactly. So let's just take blood clots, for example. Lots of people get blood clots, unfortunately, in the U.S. every day. So if you think about the fact that 4 million people are getting 2 to 4 million people are getting vaccines every day in the United States, and about 600,000 people get a blood clot a year in the United States, just by living, 10 to 20 people would get a blood clot every day in the U.S. Without the vaccine. So that speaks to your point, Larry, of not necessarily running to attribute what you might see normally happen when you have a vaccine effort at this scale.
Also, we have a question from Stacy here in West Los Angeles. Why is the vaccine one size fits all? I'm curious why smaller individuals, as Stacy is, don't get a smaller dose. She's concerned because of how petite she is, that getting the same dose that everybody gets could have an adverse outcome.
You know, I think Stacy might have something going there, but I think, you know, it's the way that it was studied, and it's probably easy on a public health intervention to rule out one size fits all with, you know, with, given the safety, the good safety signal and efficacy in the vaccine trials. But, you know, for example, we know that women probably are overrepresented in terms of vaccine side effects, and that might also be due to hormonal reasons as well as genetics. But it's something that has always been an interesting point. The same can be said about people who are larger, whether or not they should receive, you know, a different or modified dose. But these are nuances that kind of hit at the nexus of personalized medicine and public health interventions.
Well, and the implications with COVID-19 could be significant, because we know people that are obese are at much greater risk of complications from COVID-19. So if the standard dose of the vaccine does not protect the obese person as well, that's a problem.
Yes. I mean, we know that in general, you know, the trials of the vaccines kind of hit a segment of society, but people don't always think it hits necessarily the general population, because people who participate in trials might be a little bit different from the general population, both in terms of, you know, sort of ability to take care of themselves or being more savvy around health systems, et cetera, but also in the diversity of the people in the general community. But we're getting more and more information, like I think population-based studies in Israel, who's vaccinated a lot of people in their community, and the high levels of population benefit seen suggests that even though there may be outliers, that society still benefits in using this formula.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jen of L.A. says, does taking an NSAID for pain after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine make it less effective? I read that happens with some vaccines. NSAID would include ibuprofen, for example, and some other anti-inflammatories. Dr. Chin Hong?
So there are some old studies in kids showing that in the lab, showing that if you take an NSAID before, which hits on a chemical called prostaglandins that might make the immune system more sluggish, that when they gave the vaccines to the kids, that they seem to be less robust immune system. That has kind of been debunked by bigger studies later on. But nevertheless, it's CDC recommends, and it's kind of a good idea anyway, not to necessarily take something before the vaccine. But if you get symptoms, try, you know, non-pharmaceutical.
I think we just lost Dr. Chin Hong. We'll get him back on with us, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have a question about the underlying health conditions that make someone eligible to get a vaccine now. And let me just read them off while we get Dr. Chin Hong back with us. One or more of these severe health conditions qualify a person for vaccine eligibility: cancer that's current with a weakened immune system, not previous cancer, chronic kidney disease stage 4 or above, chronic pulmonary disease in which one is oxygen dependent, Down syndrome, solid organ transplant leading to a weakened immune system, pregnancy, sickle cell disease, heart conditions such as heart failure, coronary artery disease, or cardiomyopathies, but not hypertension. High blood pressure is not included. Severe obesity with a body mass index of greater than or equal to 40 kilograms, and type 2 diabetes mellitus with hemoglobin A1C level greater than 7.5%. So those are According to the California Department of Public Health, the high-risk medical conditions that are included. And I bring this up because we have a question from Lisa in La Crescenta wondering about people with asthma. She says, I don't want to be a line jumper. I'm wondering, is anyone with asthma eligible for the vaccine right now? Not according to that list that I just read off, Lisa, from the California Department of Public Health. Dr. Chin Hong, I think we got you back with us. I don't know. No, we don't. Okay. We're going to continue our conversation. We'll get Dr. Peter Chin Hong back with us on Air Talk. We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We have him back now, infectious disease specialist, UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine at UCSF, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, I was just talking about our listener's question about asthma. It is not on the list for priority for vaccines, California Department of Public Health. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it doesn't make sense in the big picture, as in the same way that type 1 diabetes is not included and type 2 diabetes is. I think there is some meaning that the absence of data doesn't mean that there is a effect, that there's no effect there. Because from a medical perspective, it makes sense that people with compromised lung function would have problems with COVID if they got it. It's just that the studies don't point to that way conclusively. And in the case of diabetes type 1, for example, there aren't enough people with diabetes type 1 who got COVID so that there are enough numbers to really show any difference. So I think you're getting at the area where, you know, there's not a ton of evidence in every subgroup of diseases, because when you chop them up, they get smaller and smaller. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't make sense. You know, they won't have a bad time with COVID if they get it.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. A chance for you to ask questions of Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center. Coming up later this hour, we're going to focus on vaccine passports that some countries like Israel are using, and there are some American companies that likely are going to require them. For example, cruise lines are likely going to adopt vaccine passports to make sure that everybody who sails on a particular cruise has been vaccinated, and that if people haven't, they wouldn't be eligible to take the cruise. We'll talk about the ethical issues and the practical issues that are raised by vaccine passports as well. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. James in Huntington Beach, you're on with Dr. Chin Hong.
Hi, Dr. Chin. I have kind of a specific question. My brother had a lung transplant a little over a year ago, but he did get both the Pfizer vaccines. And as a follow-up, they tested for antibodies, and they didn't find any antibodies. Have there been any studies in that regards, or is it possible he could get antibodies in the future, or would they suggest maybe trying another vaccine?
Was he tested for antibody response more than 2 weeks after his second dose?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, James. Dr. Chin Hong?
Yeah, so I think James is bringing up a very avant-garde area, which is that people with compromised immune systems may not actually respond in the same way as the general population. Of course, they weren't studied in the trials. They were excluded from the trials. And we know that in other vaccines like hepatitis B, people with compromised immune systems, particularly those who've received bone marrow transplants or solid organ transplants, as in the case of James's brother. But there's no guidance yet. I think we still are understanding the picture. I've heard lots of anecdotal evidence of people with some kinds of leukemias, lymphomas who've gotten bone marrow transplants who are not having detectable antibodies. So that's one issue. The second issue is that detecting antibodies by the testing that we have probably doesn't get to the complexity of our immune response. And there are certain types of other cells that are involved, like T cells, that would not be captured by the antibody test. So some companies like Adaptive are developing new kinds of testing to see if that would also give some idea about the wide repertoire of immune responses that people get after the vaccines.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Similarly to this, Jerome in Hawthorne says, I recently completed my vaccinations, but I'm wondering how to determine if they're effective. I had no symptoms after either one of the injections.
So I know a lot of people have been asking me, because there's been a lot of attention, people who get symptoms and thinking about the fact that you get symptoms as a proxy for the fact that your immune system is active. But we know that in the trials, you know, more than 50% of people actually didn't get symptoms, but yet in the Pfizer and Moderna trials, for example, they had more than 95% efficacy. So I guess the bottom line is the absence of your symptoms doesn't mean that you're not going to get a response. And to get to the question as to how to check whether or not you have responded, people are informally doing things like checking for antibody testing. But again, if it's positive, it's going to be helpful. But if it's negative, I'd be afraid that people would be worried that they didn't have an immune response, even though that test is only checking one part of the immune repertoire, like we talked about with James's question. So, you know, I would say at this point, I wouldn't run out and try to get an antibody test to show that you have efficacy and to just sort of be reassured that the vaccine is pretty good.
Peter in Long Beach says there's stuff on the internet that the vaccine isn't all that beneficial for people over the age of 80. It's hard for their body to generate antibodies. Peter wants to find out if there's any truth to that at all.
Well, I think that those words on the internet probably comes from the studies in the J&J vaccine. Over 65, it looks like the efficacy isn't as good as those under 65. But they didn't study in the J&J trials as many older individuals as those in the Pfizer-Moderna studies. So it's a very difficult, that estimate isn't very robust. So at this moment, I wouldn't necessarily put stock in that. And again, individual benefits and community benefits is, you know, versus community benefits, I'll put more stock in getting to herd immunity and not worrying about, you know, older people not getting an effect. At this point, I think the vaccines are so good that all members of society would get ample benefit.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center. I was reading about several cases that Hawaii's Public Health Department had documented. People who'd been vaccinated twice had been more than 2 weeks out and had still contracted COVID. There are people who had traveled and apparently returned to Hawaii with a positive test and an actual COVID-19. I thought it'd be good for us to talk about the fact that people are going to get COVID-19 who have been fully vaccinated. It's not 100% effective against people getting COVID-19. The biggest benefit, it seems to me, is the tremendous degree of protection against getting severe COVID.
Exactly. And in these three people in Hawaii who've been reported, none of them got severely ill. Again, speaking to your point, Larry, that, you know, as somebody in the health professions, I'm really, really excited that, you know, people don't get into the hospital, they don't get serious disease, even though there may be differences in overall infection prevention possibility from each of the vaccines and in the face of the variants.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's see, Ayush in San Diego, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
My question is, actually my dad was part of a Sinopharma trial in Dubai, and he was in the placebo group, but was recently transitioned to the vaccine group. but after his vaccination, he still got tested positive for COVID. He might visit me again in the future in the States and might be able to get another vaccine. Would he be able to, or should he get another vaccine when he visits me in the States?
And I understand you were in the Pfizer trial, right?
Yes, I myself participated in the Pfizer trial here in San Diego.
That's great. Both father and son in trials. Dr. Chin Hong?
At this point, I wouldn't necessarily get another vaccine. But I was curious, Ayush, if your dad was very ill with COVID or did he just check positive? I'm not sure if Ayush is on the line still.
Yeah, Ayush, can you answer that?
Yes, he was ill, not severely. He had back chills and he lost his sense of taste and smell. And he had a little bit of a fever as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, right now with, that Ayush's point speaks to the idea that, we focus on five vaccines in the U.S. as part of Operation Warp Speed, but there are lots of other vaccines around the world, and there will be future vaccines as well. And whether or not you take another one that might be more effective if given a chance it's really tough to say that right now. Sinopharm in particular is not terribly bad. It's a vaccine made in China. It's 79% effective from their specific trials, which, is comparable to J&J. Although I haven't and wouldn't recommend that for general use, at some point it would be interesting to see if Ayush's dad did have antibodies from that particular virus. He probably does, because if he did get infected, and certainly from the Sinopharm vaccine trial. But I also want to know when he got sick in relationship to the vaccine. So all these issues make it very complex when we think about the worldwide landscape.
Ayush, thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Ade in North Hollywood says, I had a bad allergic reaction 3 weeks after my Pfizer shot. So I'm presuming it was not from the shot. It was something else. That delayed the date of Ade's second shot, getting the second now, wondering, is that going to be as effective?
Yes, we still think that even though there are delays for some people for the second shot, that it will be effective, at least within 3 months. The official guidance is 6 weeks. But if you think about natural infection, which is, probably less responsible for less durable antibody response, the CDC guidance is 3 months for people who've gotten COVID naturally. We're being more conservative with the vaccine at 6 weeks, but, there is probably a lot of leeway in terms of getting that second shot. But of course, if you can get it on time, that's the best thing.
We have a question here. I have a roommate who won't get the vaccine due to an O blood type. Is he correct to not want it? I have already had the vaccine. I'm concerned that my roommate doesn't want to get it.
Yeah, so, the protection of O blood type versus the other types in terms of not getting COVID is so minuscule and not well substantiated that it shouldn't really be justification for not getting the vaccine. So there may be other factors at play in the roommates, and maybe having a conversation in a non-judgmental way might sort of unearth that and to distinguish between vaccine referral versus the word hesitancy, meaning that if he's hesitant, maybe there may be a time in the future where that vaccine might be something that the person might get. But, at the end of the day, I think it's important not to have vaccine shaming either. I'm sure that that's not what's going to happen, but just for all of us.
And back to Ade's point about the allergic reaction, we've heard this from a few listeners who've said, 2 or 3 weeks after they were vaccinated, they had some sort of a anaphylactic or hives or, some sort of reaction. What is the likelihood that the vaccine is responsible for that?
I think the longer you get away from the vaccine itself, the lower the chance of one of those kinds of allergic type reactions being attributed to the vaccine. So the world of allergies is divided into two main categories. Those are those that are immediate and life-threatening, and those that are sort of like less so, like poison oak, you know, or maybe an allergy to some soap. So in terms of the scary ones, those are the ones that you get observed 15 to 30 minutes after the vaccine for. If you get that, you know, days after, that's very, very unlikely due to be the vaccine. I mean, there's a small chance that some of the other effects might be vaccine related. We know that lymph nodes, Moderna arm, and all of those can happen, you know, days after the vaccine. So it just depends on the kind of allergy you're getting.
We also have another question. Someone taking prednisone, short-term therapy for an orthopedic problem. Should they wait a specified period of time after ending the prednisone before getting vaccinated?
That's a great question. Right now, there's no guidance around things like prednisone or other immunosuppressants while waiting for the vaccine or waiting a specific time before getting the vaccine. My feeling is if you're being invited to the vaccine, just get it, and then we can figure out the other stuff later on if people issue guidance. I think personally with prednisone, it's probably not going to be a big issue in terms of decreasing vaccine efficacy.
866-893-KPCC. Let's see. We have Sharon in Redondo Beach. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, yes, Doctor. I have the prothrombin gene mutation, and I had a blood clot when I was pregnant with my daughter, and I'm just wondering if it would be okay for me to move myself up a little as high, you know, risk for severe COVID, because my doctor said, you know, that it with the blood clotting issues with COVID.
That would put you at risk. That's a good question because even though you've got this state list, it, you know, is it get into less common conditions like the one you're describing, Sharon? Dr. Chin Hong?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there is a clause in the California health conditions that saying that people can be eligible for vaccines if they are, quote, individuals who are likely to develop severe life-threatening illness or death from COVID. So if Sharon's doctor believes so, you know, I would say fine for Sharon to go ahead and self-attest to getting the vaccine at this point.
All right. Very good. Sharon, we wish you all the best. Thank you so much for joining us. Lee in La Habra wonders about someone who has taken INH for tuberculosis, has dormant nodules in their lungs. I would think that in case like that, there might be more lung vulnerability. What do you think, Dr. Chin Hong?
That one is a little bit tougher unless Lee has active lung disease. So I would ask Lee to just chat with his doctor or healthcare professional to help make that decision.
So if the tuberculosis is dormant, that's not then the person doesn't necessarily have a heightened risk from COVID?
Yes, because they're, you know, latent tuberculosis infection is very, very common. And it's just depends on the degree of disability. That's why, you know, in these areas, it can sometimes be hard for people to know. You know, I think everyone can understand some of the, you know, heart disease, lung disease that's active. But these other issues depends on how much disability or ongoing disability Lee might be having.
All right. Dr. Chin Hong, great to talk with you as always. Thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk. We appreciate it and have a terrific rest of the week.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine and a noted infectious disease specialist, part of our Air Talk COVID-19 coverage family for now more than a year. It's Air Talk. We'll be back to talk about COVID vaccination passports. Some countries are using them, and it's expected some businesses are going to require some degree of proof of vaccination, like cruise lines have already announced this. We'll talk about some of the ethical issues that are raised, as well as the practical matter, such as avoiding counterfeit passports. We'll get to that in just 90 seconds on Air Talk.
Support comes from Ciclovia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclovia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclovia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.